because of the experiences that I have had with opposition to my gender, particularly in bathrooms, and even more so, I've been fired from jobs for being transgender. I've, you know, witnessed all kinds of discrimination just based on my gender identity.
Peyton, we're going to leave it here because this is the end of the show. We just got you up. We're sorry we weren't able to get that satellite a little before, but we're going to continue this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Peyton McGarry, thanks so much for being with us, plaintiff in the federal lawsuit filed against North Carolina and Chase Strangeau of the ACLU. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us.
A Washington Post investigation revealed that of all fatal shootings by police in 2015, almost one quarter involved a person who was mentally unstable. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on April 4th to hear St. Helens Police Chief Terry Moss discuss how crisis intervention training is changing how police interact with people with mental illness and how police are helping to divert them from incarceration. That's Prison Pipeline, April 4th at 6:30 p.m. A Washington Post investigation revealed that of all fatal shootings by police,
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths on Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center in Portland. The film will be introduced by Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There will also be a Q&A session after the film. Again, that's a screening of the film, Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths with Richard Gage, Saturday, April 2nd, at the Portland State University Lincoln Performance Center, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It is 5:01, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Ben's Les Schwab Amphitheater, presenting Widespread Panic's Only Northwest Shows, July 2nd and 3rd. Tickets for Widespread Panic's summer concerts on sale Friday at benconcerts.com. And now stay tuned for the KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a beloved active Portland attorney, Stu Sugarman, has died.
We invite Ajamu Bumi of the All African People's Revolutionary Party to speak on his experience with Assata Shakur in her political asylum in Cuba.
For News in Depth, we sat down with Willie Levinson to gain perspective on the Willamette River and our right to access its shores.
Thank you.
Sorry, we're having a little bit of technical difficulties there. Just in our upcoming hour, we're going to be having Ajamu Umi of All African People's Revolutionary Party to speak on his experience with Assata Shakur and her political asylum in Cuba. I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Portland civil rights attorney Stu Sugarman has died. Please tune into the KBOO Evening News tomorrow night for a report on his life.
Google has laid plans for further expansion in the Dalles. The internet giant has bought another 75 acres of land from Northwest Aluminum, which ran a smelter on the site until 2000. The costs and terms of the sale are so far undisclosed. That's in addition to the 23 acres acquired last year from the Port of the Dalles, on which it's constructing a new 10 million cubic foot data center. Google insists it has no immediate plans to develop the new site, but says the acquisition makes room for growth to meet future demand as internet use continues to balloon. It's promising more local jobs in the coming years. Data centers in Oregon are property tax exempt, a move aimed at encouraging companies like Google, Amazon, and Facebook to locate here and to grow. Worldwide, Google has been criticized for exploiting national tax laws in order to maximize its profits. In the UK, it uses European law to avoid paying any corporation tax to the British government. Google is famously secretive about what goes on at its Dalles operation, but recently released a video inviting viewers inside for the first time.
Officials at the Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant near Richmond, Washington, shut the plant due to a cooling problem yesterday, but they said no radiation was released. A spokesman from the Energy Northwest, which operates the plant, insists that there is no danger to the public. The Associated Press reports that they hope to restart the plant later this week. Energy Northwest officials say they believe the water system valve may not have been in the right position, and they have launched an investigation. It's not the first time the plant's operations have been stopped. Another shutdown was recorded in November 2009 after a leak of hydraulic fluid. Last fall, the Tri-City Herald newspaper reported on a series of pinhole leaks, which were discovered in fuel rods at the plant. At the time, officials said the leaks may have been due to manufacturing defects. Minoru Yasui was a lawyer and prescient civil rights activist who fought to bring justice to the systemic mistreatment and discrimination toward Japanese Americans. Yesterday, Governor Kate Brown made it official that March 28th will be remembered as official Minoru Yasui Day throughout Oregon. KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama went to a rally held yesterday to get some further perspective.
A crowd of over 200 people gathered at the old police headquarters in downtown Portland on Monday. They were there to honor the legacy of Oregon civil rights hero Minoru Yasui.
Sir, you must arrest me. Arrest you? Look, son, why don't you
Two men reenacted the moment in 1942 when Yasui walked into the police station and demanded to be arrested for breaking a government curfew. Yasui was attempting to challenge the law that restricted the civil rights of Japanese Americans during World War II. And as a practicing attorney, he understood the consequences of his actions. Yasui would go on to serve 9 months in solitary confinement and be placed in an internment camp in Idaho. After the war, Yasui continued to practice law in Oregon and to fight for civil rights. In 2015, he was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and on Monday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed a bill declaring every March 28th as Minoru Yasui Day in the state of Oregon. I spoke with some of the people at the rally about why it was important for them to be there.
I think there have been situations in our past where maybe we didn't act the right way, and I don't really want to see us go down that path again.
Minoru Yasui's struggle and the Japanese Americans, my parents' generation, are why I became a lawyer.
Hoping that something like this will never happen again, you know, certainly not to our community, not in this country, and hopefully not around the world either, but, you know, at least start here locally. So I think, you know, this is the first step, hopefully, towards more awareness.
I think especially in this political climate of xenophobia and all this fear, that we should really sort of remember the lessons of the past.
If we can bring Min's story to more people, then I think it'll quell the fears and the hate and try and get it back to peace and justice, and that we should treat people as people and not assume what they are because of this color of their skin or their name or whatever.
I'm a historian in Portland, and it's important for me to come out here and recognize what Min Yasui did. He's a huge figure in Oregon and nationally and internationally, and I don't think many people know his story, so it gives some coverage to him and recognition finally.
He went up and down the street trying to get the police to arrest him for violating curfew because he wanted to take this to the courts. It was so important for American identity.
It's important to me because my great-grandparents, my grandparents, and my parents were in the internment camps. And I'm actually an attorney as well, and I'm a Japanese-American, and Min Yasui was the first Japanese-American attorney in Oregon.
This gentleman stood for things that we are dealing with right now, and it's a little mind-blowing that here it is years and years later, and we're still dealing with the same stuff, and it's very scary.
I think it's really great to help support, well, one, equality for everyone, and the sacrifices that Min was willing to make to kind of help us earn what we have now.
Whatever he went through, none of us could ever imagine. To give up his whole life, his career, and to give that up to prove that our civil rights were being, what happened was wrong, I think is just very admirable.
I think when anybody's oppressed, it affects all of us.
What's been happening worldwide, it's really important that we keep on telling the story. You cannot tell it enough. People keep forgetting.
These supporters hope that the story of one man can help teach future generations about the continuing fight for civil rights. With an entire day dedicated to the memory of that one man's struggle, these civil rights supporters seem to be making sure that their voices are heard. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
With President Barack Obama's visit to Cuba last week, many observers wondered whether our government was negotiating to extradite Black Panther activist Assata Shakur. Here in Portland, the All African People's Revolutionary Party had already been planning to air their documentary about the beloved activist, who many believe was falsely accused of killing a police officer in the U.S. in the early 1970s. Here to talk about the case and the event is Ajamo Umi, a grassroots organizer who traveled to Cuba years ago to record the interview with Shakur, which is being aired tomorrow night at Portland State University. Ajamo, thanks for being with us here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell us about the event tomorrow night. What do you have planned?
So what we're showing tomorrow night is a video of a discussion that I videotaped when I met Sister Assata in Havana at the Federation of Cuban Women in 1994, actually. The interesting thing about it is that I had it on a tape for many years, so I just recently got it converted, so now I can use it. But it's timeless because with everything happening with Cuba, she's talking about socialist development there. And what she's talking about, since people in the U.S. generally have such a lack of information about what socialism actually is, it's really going to be perfect to show this right now, even though it's actually 22 years old.
Could you tell us about this amazing woman? Talk about Assata Shakur. How did you come to meet her?
Well, in 1994, I went there with another comrade from our party in the Bay Area. We went there together as a part of a delegation. We were actually guests of the government when we went there. We have relationships with the Cuban government. So we went there, and when we got there, they asked us what we wanted to do in addition to the number of activities they had planned for us. And so I wrote down that I wanted to meet Assata Shakur, and I wanted to meet Harry Villegas, who was actually the bodyguard for Che Guevara. And actually ended up getting to meet both of them. I had no idea it was going to happen. But when we met Assata, she, talked to us. We hung out with her for actually 4 or 5 days. We even went to the beach together.
Did you walk along the Malecón?
We walked along the Malecón several times until 3 or 4 in the a.m. Yes.
So what's your take on Obama's visit to Cuba? What did it accomplish for the U.S., do you think?
Well, I mean, of course, the U.S. is always about capitalism and promoting private business interests. And so that's their motivation for establishing relationships with Cuba. If you've been to Cuba like I have, it's a beautiful country. It's a great destination. It's a place people would want to go and spend a lot of money. So that's their motivation. But I don't see this, and we don't see this what's happening between the U.S. and Cuba is about America controlling this relationship. We believe that, you know, Cuba also has their interests, and they know what their interests are, and that's their motivation for pursuing this relationship.
And what do you think about the rumors about the extradition of Assata Shakur? Do you think this is something that Obama and Raul Castro actually spoke about?
I doubt seriously that Obama would bring that up. As arrogant as he was when he went down there, people here have to realize that there are a lot of other things at play. There are a number of terrorists who still live today in Florida, in Miami. Luis Posada Corrales is one of them. He was convicted in Venezuelan court of masterminding the shooting down of a Cuban airline that had the Cuban youth soccer team in 1977, killing 73 people. This guy is on the CIA payroll, and he walks around in Miami, and everybody listening to this right now, you're paying for him to do that. So obviously the U.S. government does not want you to know these types of contradictions, because it would expose them as the hypocrite they are when they claim that they're against terrorism, when they're paying for terrorists to walk around in Florida every day. So they're not going to bring up Assata Shakur being extradited, because the minute they do, the Cubans are going to start talking about Luis Posada Corrales and all the other terrorists that are harbored in southern Florida.
Do you know what her wishes are?
In terms of, I'm sure that she has family here. So, you know, when I talk to her, and I'm sure, you know, we have delegations that continue to go, so we stay in constant touch with her. I'm sure her desire is to be able to reunite with her family. I'm sure her desire is to be able to come and go as she pleases.
When you visited, you mentioned it was in 1994, right?
Correct.
That was a pretty tough time for a lot of Cubans. Did Assata have a pretty tough time kind of weathering that economic crisis?
Well, and that's the whole thing that she's talking about in the video, and everything she's talking about still applies today. Actually, a lot of what she's talking about is prophetic for what's happening in Cuba today. So I wouldn't say that people had a hard time per se. Like, I judge Cuba in relationship to the countries around Cuba who have the same historical and cultural history, and compared to all those countries, with no disrespect to them. But if you look at Jamaica, you look at Haiti, you look at Puerto Rico, wonderful countries, and you look at Cuba, Cuba's actually doing quite well as it relates to the people.
And so why right now? Why decide to organize this event for AAPRP?
Well, we organize events on Assata Shakur. I've done it for 30 years. So I first learned about Assata Shakur when I was 17, and I've been engaged in events to try to educate the public about her since then. So, you know, this is just a normal part of our routine. We always have something that accentuates the role of women in March, and so this just happened to be the film. This was planned way in advance of what Obama's doing, so it has nothing to do with that. It's just a part of our regular program of political education.
And so I just want to shift gears really quick and start talking about Marilyn Buck Abolitionist Collective's event that's on Thursday, Trump is America. Can you talk about the Marilyn Buck Abolitionist Collective?
Right. The Marilyn Buck Abolitionist Collective, or MBAC as it's called, is a group of concerned, primarily white European activists here in the Portland, Oregon area, who have come together wanting to create an organizational perspective that is anti-capitalist, that is looking at socialism as a solution, and that is not looking at partnering with the African Liberation Movement or other movements by people of color with this concept that we're here to help you. We don't need that kind of help. But their perspective is more one of, we need to fight to change this system because it's a backward system for everybody that lives here. So that group, we played a role in helping found about a year and a half ago. And they are participating in having a number of wonderful events and developing work designed around doing work within European white communities against white supremacy and capitalism.
John, can you tell us, how can listeners support your work that you're doing right now?
Well, the main thing is, you know, if you want to come to events, everybody's welcome to come to events. We have everybody's welcome tomorrow night. We have a free breakfast program we do in North Portland. We have a independent school project that we're working on out there in the same neighborhood in North Portland. So, you know, our website is www.aaprporegon.org. People are encouraged to go there. We can always use help with donations for food for the breakfast program. We have a lot of wonderful people here that provide that, but there's a way on the website that you can donate money, and we use that to buy the juice for the children.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. Thanks, Ajamu. I really appreciate you taking the time and sitting down with us to talk about this.
Thanks for having me.
That was Ajamu Umi of the AAPRP, All African People's Revolutionary Party. Their event on Wednesday night is Assata Shakur's Talks About Socialism in Cuba. It screens at Portland State University Smith Memorial Center, room number 236. from 6 to 9 p.m., and that's at 1825 Southwest Broadway. The Maryland Buck Abolitionist Collective's event, Trump is America, Revolutionary Perspectives on the 2016 Election, is Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Center, room number 236 as well. Find out more on Facebook at the Maryland Buck Abolitionist Collective and also on the All African People's Revolutionary Party Portland, Oregon.
Earlier this month, a liquefied natural gas export terminal in Jordan Cove, Oregon, was shot down by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This was considered a surprising and significant victory over the interests representing the fossil fuel complex. However, over the past Easter weekend, a troubling development emerged in Coos County. For more, we go to a broadcast from this morning's KBOO show, Air Cascadia, with Chris Andre.
We have Jody McCaffrey waiting on the line, Citizens Against LNG, a person who's absolutely tireless, someone who does not turn out for direct actions and hikes and so forth. She does, but not just for that when the weather is nice. It's someone who works constantly and tirelessly 24 hours a day all year round on this, it would appear. Good morning, Jody. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So there have been some over now. We are happy. We were very happy recently. There had been a victory at Jordan Cove. Many people thought, how about that? We did it. It's over. Hurrah. What's next? Turns out what's next is basically the same thing. What can you tell me a bit about what just happened? Overnight, essentially.
Yes, well, overnight to me, because I wasn't totally paying attention.
They always do it. They always do it. They do it on holidays. Easter, boom, there it is. Thanksgiving, boom, there it is. Christmas, boom. And watch, it's going to happen on the 4th of July. Think up a holiday, any holiday, and then sit there and wait. You just wait for the rat to come out of the hole. Guaranteed, there is a rat in the hole. It'll be out on the holiday when no one's looking. So what happened in the aftermath of this recent holiday?
Well, as you know, FERC issued an order actually denying Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector based on a couple things. One was that they didn't have contracts, and the other one was that they hadn't acquired approval from landowners. 90% of the landowners had not signed off, and there was a lot of issues with the landowners. So today, well, I discovered this late last night because I've been gone. I come in, and they had put it on. There were things that they added to the late agenda item, but what they have today at the Coos County Commission meeting is on the consent calendar, which means you don't really have any discussion about it. They're approving a right-of-way and easement for Williams Pacific Connector. That's the gas pipeline for Jordan Cove.
So they just went ahead and approved it, despite objections, despite public outcry across the state.
Besides, the FERC order denying it, and you know, them knowing Jordan Cove doesn't have most of the land use processes. I can't think of any that there might be a few like for little tiny things, but most of their main land use processes have all these conditions of approval that Pacific Connector and Jordan Cove have not met. And there's a huge land use process for the terminal that hasn't even been gone through the decision process yet, the hearing where we've been waiting for the hearings officer's decision to come down. And yet they're going ahead as if this is already, you know, done, signed, deal, delivered, and no public input. There was never a public process that I know of. I stayed up half the night commenting on these three items because the second item is they're actually changing the Coos County Code, and they're having a hearing about that, which they just put out last week that they were doing this on a bulletin board at the county, and of course it's on the agenda, to change the wording of the permits for work in a right-of-way. And then, of course, the late agenda item is they have 10 parcels of land, forest land, that the county's selling, and they don't tell you who they're selling it to, but you pretty much know what that's about. And really, they're going to say they had a public process. They put it on, you know, just before the close of business yesterday, and we're supposed to know about these things and be able to change our plans, which I have other things that I had scheduled today, so I can't be there. So it's very frustrating. I should have known. Easter holiday, I should have been paying extra special attention.
I wasn't. Jody, hang on a second. We're almost out of time. I'm hoping to see on the Citizens Against LNG website a list. What you've just told us is a lot. The sale of trees very likely the pipeline company. All the rest of it is illegal. It is in fact illegal what they did. They went around legal processes over a holiday weekend, and this is what came out. If we want to see it on that website, we'll put that up on the KBOO website. If listeners hear this and they are outraged, and they should be, you should be outraged. Call the governor, write to the governor, email the governor, have your voice heard. This Coos Bay Jordan Cove belongs to all of us as Oregonians, and as such, we are responsible. Jody, thank you so much. My guests today have been, of course, Kathy Halloran and Jody McCaffrey. This has been a Cascadia for Tuesday, March 29th.
That was KBOO's Chris Andre from Air Cascadia this morning.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this for news in depth, followed by This Way Out at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. The weather this evening is supposed to be clear all through until tomorrow evening. Low this evening is 41 degrees. Tomorrow it's going to be sunny. High of 73 with partly cloudy skies into the evening. Today in history, in 1974, 8 Ohio National Guardsmen were indicted on charges stemming from the shooting of 4 students at Kent State University on May 4th of 1970. All of the guardsmen were later acquitted. The quote of the day is, "No one is going to give you the education you need to overthrow them. Nobody's going to teach you your true history, teach you your true heroes, if they know that that knowledge will help set you free." And that's by Assata Shakur.
It's 5:27, time for a daily commentary. It's 5:27, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you wonder why Congress critters keep ignoring what the people want them to do while doing things that the people don't want them doing, take a peek at the unique PR campaign now being run by the pharmaceutical industry. The public is dismayed and disgusted by the flagrant greed of drug makers that are shamefully zooming the prices of medicines into the stratosphere, turning necessities into unaffordable luxuries. As a result, there's a growing demand for Congress to take action to stop the industry's out-of-control gouging. To counter this, drug companies have launched a massive advertising campaign running on radio, in print, and on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media websites. Yet it's not likely that you've seen or heard any of them. That's because drug chieftains don't care what you and I think. Moreover, they know they couldn't possibly persuade us to let them keep jacking up our prices. So their public relations effort has made the odd and seemingly counterproductive move of sidestepping the actual public, instead narrowly targeting a very tiny audience. As one CEO arrogantly put it, We've identified 7,000 Americans who matter, thus dismissing the other 330 million of us as nobodies. We're focusing on those in policy positions to fight structural issues, he sniffed. By structural issues, he means convincing Congress to take no action to help consumers by reforming the present pricing structure of monopolistic drug makers, whose guiding corporate ethic is, bleed 'em for all they've got. This is Jim Hightower saying, so this is a surreptitious PR campaign meant to reach only the eyes and ears of policy elites. The goal is to have Congress, once again, ignore what the people want it to do, thus allowing the corporate few who matter to keep fleecing the many. The word for this is plutocracy. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Department of Justice is allowing local police jurisdictions to keep assets seized under certain laws for themselves, the Washington Post reports today. The so-called equitable sharing program allows local police the right to prosecute certain crimes using federal statutes that allow asset forfeiture when even local laws do not. The federal department had stopped asset forfeiture payments to police agencies in December because budget cuts depleted operating funds in last year's federal spending law. But now they've resumed. The practice is controversial because, critics say, it gives a financial incentive to police departments to charge people with crimes on the principle of the fact that they get to keep the alleged wrongdoer's cash and property. The Washington Post reports that federal law allows local police to keep up to 80% of assets they seize. Nationally, in 2014, the Post reports that over $5 billion in assets were seized under federal jurisdiction, which is more than the amount of money stolen in all of the cumulative burglary cases that year.
A Minnesota man has invented a handgun designed to look like a cell phone. The weapon, expected to go on sale this fall, is worrying both law enforcement agencies and police accountability activists. The inventor, Kirk Kjellberg, says he got the idea after being called out by a small child for carrying a concealed weapon in a restaurant. Kjellberg told reporters that he was looking for a gun designed to make it easier to hide concealed weapons without public shaming. The gun inventor said he's already been contacted by Homeland Security, and he expects to work with them to train officers on how to identify the cell phone gun in street interactions.
The state of Alabama is attempting a bold move in the wake of the controversy caused by the fight over same-sex marriage. A bill currently making its way through the Alabama state legislature states, quote, all requirements to obtain a marriage license by the state of Alabama are hereby abolished and repealed. The requirement of a ceremony of marriage to solemnize the marriage is abolished. If passed, the bill will effectively eliminate state-issued marriage licenses. The newlyweds would simply submit signed affidavits, and the state would record their marriage. There would still be a few state regulations regarding marriage. Minors between the age of 16 and 18 would need signed parental approval before marriage. The state would not record a marriage if either of the two parties are already married, and the parties could not be related by blood or adoption. Since the Supreme Court ruling that legitimized same-sex marriages, several Alabama probate judges have refused to issue marriage licenses on the grounds that it would violate their religious beliefs. This bill seeks to address that by removing the state from the business of marriage altogether. The bill, SB 143, has made it through the Alabama State Senate and is now moving onto the House, and then, pending their approval, onto Governor Bentley's desk.
Also in U.S. Justice Department news, a new federal review has found that federal prison authorities are failing to provide adequate medical care for thousands of inmates because of staffing shortages. The problem is made worse by overcrowding prisons and the increasingly elderly prison population due to the aging of the baby boom generation. In some facilities, the staff is down by as much as 40% from what is needed, officials say. The report by the U.S. Justice Department Inspector General says prison doctors are paid about 55% more in the private sector, and dentists are paid about 112% more. In response, federal officials say they will ramp up recruitment of new doctors.
Public sector unions won a major victory at the Supreme Court today. A deadlocked 4-4 decision upheld the union's right to collect mandatory fees from workers. The case, Fredericks v. California Teachers Association, was brought by a group of school teachers who argued that the fee requirement was a violation of their First Amendment rights. The court seemed poised to agree with them. After all, arguments took place in January. But Justice Antonin Scalia's death last month left the court evenly divided along ideological lines. Today's split decision automatically affirms the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which sided with the union in 2014. 35% of American public employees are unionized, compared with under 7% in the private sector. While President Obama's nominee for the court vacancy, Merrick Garland, met with lawmakers on Capitol Hill today, the Republican-controlled Senate still refuses to consider any prospective justice until after Obama leaves office next year.
Donald Trump's campaign manager is finding himself at the center of some negative attention. Corey Lewandowski was charged with battery in the state of Florida yesterday. The charge stems from an incident that happened during a news conference that was held on March 8th. During the conference, Lewandowski forcefully grabbed a news reporter, Michelle Fields, as she sought to interview Trump. Afterward, both Trump and Lewandowski denied Fields' account of being assaulted, publicly calling her, quote, totally delusional, despite a Washington Post reporter describing the event in one of his news stories. Today, a court affidavit was submitted by the Jupiter, Florida Police Department that charges Lewandowski with a battery, a charge supported by footage from security cameras in Trump's own club. Trump's campaign has issued a statement defending Lewandowski and gave no indication that he would be suspended or otherwise removed from his duties as a manager. As an odd side note to the story, one of the two lawyers who have been named Lewandowski's defense team has had legal troubles of his own. Kendall Coffey is a former U.S. attorney who resigned from his post after an incident in which he bit a stripper so hard that he drew blood. While he too initially denied the charge, a subsequent investigation proved otherwise.
Israel's parliament has just unanimously approved legislation that aims to limit the pay gap between bosses and workers. The new law, which applies to both the banking and the insurance industries, caps compensation at about $660,000 per year, or no more than 44 times the salary of the lowest paid worker. Anything above the ceiling would be subject to higher taxes. Recently, senior banker salaries in Israel have risen to as much as $2.1 million per year. The average salary in Israel is about $30,000 per year. In Europe, there has been strong opposition to any mandatory ratios of the highest allowable salaries compared to the lowest. In the U.S., financial firms must disclose what their pay ratios are, but there are no laws mandating what the ratios must be. The law has garnered widespread appeal from the Israeli government, but, as expected, is being opposed by the banking community. Some commenters have called it a populist measure that may lead to higher costs for the public if banks react by raising their charges for financial transactions. Israel's Association of Banks is expected to appeal the law in the country's Supreme Court.
A Palestinian videographer and human rights worker based in Hebron, whose video of the murder of a 21-year-old Palestinian by an Israeli soldier has received widespread attention and has received a number of death threats. Videographer Imad Abu Shamisa also says that the Israeli police and military who interrogated him about the video said that they will not protect him if he is attacked. One of the many death threats the videographer has received since the video was posted on the internet included a threat to burn him alive, like the Dabwasha family. This is a reference to a Palestinian family who were burned to death while asleep in their beds last July. The mother, father, and 18-month-old baby were killed, and the 4-year-old brother was severely burned. The video footage in question shows very clearly what Palestinians have been saying for years, that Israeli soldiers frequently shoot and kill Palestinians who are lying down, prone, wounded, or otherwise incapacitated and pose no threat. The Palestinian who filmed the incident says he now fears for his life and the life of his family. Israeli settlers on Friday gathered outside his home in Hebron to hurl abuse at him, a day after he captured on camera the Israeli soldier's assassination of a wounded Palestinian who was lying on the ground bleeding.
And now we go to a community rights commentary with Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you are listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today I'm going to be sharing a very brief excerpt of an extraordinary new essay written by Trioth Bullock, a dear friend of mine who lives here in Portland. Trioth has been a tireless advocate for the land and water rights of Native peoples across Cascadia bioregion for his entire adult life. The title of Trioth's essay is "Tolerating the Bundy Militia Cattlemen Association of Malheur is Comparable to Tolerating a KKK Occupation of a Black Church, the Historical Amnesia That Got Us There." Witnessing the cattlemen militia occupation of Malheur and the governmental tolerance of it has been outrageous and dumbfoundingly violent when viewed from a First Peoples perspective, in this case, the Burns Paiute tribe. The occupiers reveal common ignorance and insensitivity to the larger story of colonization in what has become the state of Oregon. By both domestic and international law, it can easily be argued that the Burns Paiute tribe holds a legitimate title to the land in dispute based on their 12,000 years of occupation and ongoing unceded presence in the landscape. Citizen militias in the Oregon country were historically enlisted for decades with the support of the region's public newspapers in a public campaign of extermination against First Peoples. No one has ever been held to account for these crimes, and in fact, many of the militia murderers in the early history were given financial reward by Congress. To understand the current status of land title in Oregon and the unique status of the U.S. government and First Peoples in the federal legal system, one has to go back to the origins of English common law's definitions of land title and the first European international law, the Doctrine of Discovery, which arises from Roman Catholic papal bulls going back as far as the 12th century and which were imposed upon the North American landscape in the formation of the USA. All land title in the U.S. originates on Doctrine of Discovery legal principles. The Supreme Court made the Discovery Doctrine formal U.S. case law in the 1823 Johnson v. McIntosh decision. The U.S. Supreme Court last used this case law as recently as 1997, 2001, and 2005 to suppress Indian rights. The Doctrine of Discovery and the law which arises from it are based on the belief that European Christians are superior to all other peoples and so can bestow on themselves rights of ownership, which peoples of other races and religions cannot. That this law remains at the foundation of property law in the U.S. reveals that genocidal violence is not simply a historic colonial period of expansion reality, but remains active through legal continuities of takings. The occupants at Malheur seem insensitive to the realities of this history and less than aware of themselves as manifestations of the continuance of this violence. The Malheur Wildlife Refuge is Northern Paiute unceded lands, formerly the 1.8 million-acre Malheur River Indian Reservation. The Paiute people were quote-unquote given the 1.8 million-acre Malheur Indian Reservation in 1872. Within just a few years, they were killed in the hundreds or thousands, depending on your sources, when forced out of Oregon altogether. By the 1950s, many tribal nation citizens were being terminated by accepting relocation fees to move to cities. According to the Oregon History Project, quote, all of the Paiute who were removed to Washington Territory had left the Yakima Reservation by 1883. Some moved to the Warm Springs Reservation or to Nevada, while others returned to the Harney Basin, settling near Burns. In 1972, the Burns Paiute tribe acquired title to 771 acres of land, forming the Burns Paiute Indian Reservation, unquote. Perhaps it's time that we give the Paiute people the chance to teach the ancient first law of this land, and we all get an education on our responsibilities. The Paiute people never ceded the land, and ethically, all occupiers should be looking to their leadership as guests in these lands that the Paiute have stewarded for thousands of years. I've been reading a very brief excerpt from a much longer essay written by Trioth Bullock titled Tolerating the Bundy militia cattleman occupation of Malheur is comparable to tolerating a KKK occupation of a black church, the historical amnesia that got us there. I urge you to read the full essay on his blog that can be accessed at treoath.wordpress.com. That's treoath.wordpress.com. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KABU Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dominic Anaya, Les Hudson, Jetty Yokoyama, Tony Latigre, Robin Ryan, Will Lambeth, and Chris Andre. The producer is Kanan Schlesinger. Our engineer is Liam Delta. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Paula Roland hosting Talk Radio. At 9, it's host Delphine Crescenzo, and she's joined by the Queer Students of Color Conference Planning Committee to discuss the 6th annual conference that will take place on April 16th and 17th. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's